Good morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Wake up and get yourself to church, yeah. Well, thank you for tuning in here. We're another episode of Live at CDA. I am crazy excited to talk to Todd Martin, who was a top four in the world tennis player, made his way to the finals of a couple of Grand Slam events. And I know him from coming to see me in my office, which was in the third floor of my house at the time, and in comes this really tall guy with his whole family into my really small studio office, and I just felt kind of embarrassed that he was there and the whole thing, and his Midwest charm and his kind attitude made it everyone feel at ease. And then later, even a few weeks later, I realized that he was the new incoming CEO of the Tennis Hall of Fame, which was interesting because our office was just finishing a big addition for the Tennis Hall of Fame. So then I got to know him on that realm as well. But it's my great honor to have you hear from Todd about what his life's been like and the ups and downs of life and what he's learned from it so that we can all take away some jewel and gem from his experiences that we can put into our own life. And so, Todd, thanks for coming. And
thanks, Spencer. Yeah, right. I'm happy to be here.
So first off would be, tell us about the childhood, Todd Martin. What happened? Where did you come from? Why are you like the way you are? Just tell us a little brief history.
I grew up in Ohio and Michigan, primarily Michigan, or I identify as being from Michigan. My mom has her master's in phys ed, so okay. Very athletically minded. My father was a corporate counsel in the automotive industry, and that took us up to Michigan. One older sister who kept me in line fairly well. I was a timid young boy, but I was always interested and compelled by competition and game playing, whether it was tiddlywinks, crossword puzzles, whatever. Basketball was my first love, but there was something in my wiring that really, I think, was predisposed for the sport of tennis. The independence, the self-reliance, the self-motivation, in some ways sort of the obsessive focus that's necessary. And I found, when we moved to Michigan, I was 10, and we found one tennis club in town. My dad went to work, asked, where do I take my kid? And they're like, well, the one place. Who do I ask for? The one guy. Yeah. And that gentleman is the godfather of our oldest child and the best educator I've ever met. Oh, wow. And so it's sort of just like a perfect storm pretty early in my life.
Yeah.
Because I was not the most athletic kid. Mm-hmm. I was very coordinated, but I was taught really, really well, and I had a very open mind to learning.
So that's what got the tennis bug growing in you?
Yeah, my parents got me started, and I was taught well for a few years in Ohio, but I think puberty is a huge challenge for every child and definitely for young athletes. Do you become less coordinated through that experience? Do you get distracted with other interests and so forth? And so if it weren't for my childhood coach, I don't know what would have happened, but he pushed all the right buttons all the time and just constantly stimulated my interest in learning more and deepened my passion for the sport every step of the way.
Wow. Was there other sports as well, or was tennis like kind of right in there?
Yeah, so I gave up. Basketball was the last organized sport I gave up, and that was around 14.
Were you tall for your age?
I was always, always tall and gangly. You know, sort of like, it's not pretty. Not that it's pretty now or ever was, but it was certainly not pretty then. And I didn't really finish growing until I was about 20 or 21 years old. So college was really good for me from a physical maturation standpoint. But basketball was probably, even when I stopped playing organized basketball, I was probably still playing more basketball than I was tennis.
Oh, really? Okay.
So in high school, except for during the high school tennis season, I would play 6 hours a week. Mm. It's Michigan, cold, yeah. expensive indoor courts, so sure. forth and so on. I could always find a basketball court. I could always play stickball in the driveway of okay. my neighbor's house, football in their backyard, whatever. I was probably getting 20 plus hours worth of physical fitness yeah. a week.
Sure.
But only six of those were okay. dedicated to tennis.
So the idea that, you know, see kids like super focused at a super early age, what's your thought on that? Looking backwards, looking forwards with your own kids, yeah. what do you think?
I think early specialization is a real curse.
Oh, okay.
It's a problem in all sports now. Mm. Tennis, it was a problem earlier than others. It leads to overuse injury, which one of our children had. Our middle guy used to be a gymnast, and yeah, he was only doing it 3 days a week, but he was doing it at a period of time where he was growing a lot and injured a growth plate. Overuse injuries, I think a lot of stress on the family. Pursuing any sport is costly, but it shouldn't have to be.
Right.
You know, we all can find a basketball court, a baseball field, a tennis court, a football, whatever, really easily. And but the way our youth sports leagues and systems are set up tells you got to get on the road. My oldest was nine, and the only basketball outlet for him that was at the proper level for him just to be interested in or maintain his interest in the sport was at the AAU level. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so he joined an AAU team in a suburb of Jacksonville, Florida, and he wasn't good enough to play more than a quarter of the game yet. And the coach's stated objective was to get to nationals in Charlotte, North Carolina. The first couple of games, you know, they won by 40 points. Like, geez, these kids are pretty good.
Yeah.
We drove 15 minutes into Jacksonville, Florida, and there were four teams in one tournament that my son's team lost to by 50 points. And,
okay,
and I'm thinking to myself, why do you want to go to Charlotte? Just go back and forth into Jacksonville. I think there's just such obsession about college scholarship and deeming youth sports to be an investment in a child's life, not for the child. It is, there's a vicariousness that is involved there. And I think there's really good evidence that the more well-rounded the athlete is, the more sports they're familiar with, the better they ultimately are at the sport that they choose to be focused on. And that period of time around puberty is critical. Yeah. I sort of instinctively chose tennis after I'd hit my growth spurt, after I'd reached puberty, okay. and it was the right time for me. But I have friends who were way better than me at 12, fully invested in tennis, and they didn't end up much better than they were at 12 because they grew differently than others.
It's interesting. I'm glad to hear you say that because I try to figure that out. And looking back on my own career and hearing that from you, it's like you want to try to help your kid get to peak at the right time. And if they're trying to peak at 5 and 7 and 12, they're probably not going to peak at the right time later. They're burned out, they're bummed, it's not fun anymore, and they've lost that love, which is what makes you want to go out there and compete.
So I played professionally until I was 34, and had it not been trying to travel and raise a family at the same time and making the decision, do my wife and I try to raise our son in a 15 by 15 hotel room all over God's half acre, or do we raise the child with dad halfway around the world and, you know, only being a bit part in his life? If it weren't for those things, I would have kept playing. I loved playing tennis.
That's so great.
I felt competitive still, but the reason I still loved to play tennis was I never experienced burnout. The passion for the sport persisted, and I think in large part because my parents wouldn't allow me more of it when I was young. It was candy for me.
You just wanted it. Yeah.
It was candy. I would have gone every day. If that's where the car would have driven, that's where I would have gone.
That's so funny. That's so great. Well, lots of lessons to be learned there. So speaking of peaking early, when you look back and say, what were the differentiating factors? What sparked it? Was it a work ethic? Was it technique? Was it athletic ability or wind or stamina? Like what? Where do you think those things sort of piled up? Like, where did it click?
So I referenced some wiring. I think there's a lot that we need to uncover about ourselves. Mm. And I'm actually doing a course right now that's asking me some pretty deep questions about who I am, which is a great refresher, and it's good for some introspection. But I do think wiring is really important. And my wiring was, I had a high level of focus. My parents instilled in me a work ethic that, anything but your best was not acceptable. And not the best result, but the best input had to be there. Yeah.
Right.
And then to add to that, my coach, when I was about 14 years old, instituted the A&E team, playing off of the old TV show, the A-Team.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I see.
And he said his was the attitude and effort team. And okay. So every practice we ever had from that time on, we had to take turns stepping inside of a student circle and rate ourselves on a scale of 1 to 10 for attitude and for effort.
Wow. And what, how old was that?
I was 14.
Okay. It's a great time to learn that.
Yeah. And then if I didn't tell the truth, Joe and Sue had to speak up and say, you know what, you say 9 and 8 in attitude and effort, but you were complaining about a line call and you didn't run for that ball. And so if our peer group didn't stand up and say, that's not right, then we hit the track basically.
Wow.
And just, we were punished.
You got paid for it.
We were punished.
Wow. Well, that, man, what a great lesson to learn though early in life. The attitude and effort is the foundation, not the actual results, right? Because we seem to want to always go to results and say, well, he won. He's a jerk, but he won. Or he...
Yeah. Two things there. One, my coach and my parents, I guess. My coach was in line with my parents. My parents were in line with the coach.
All right, that sounds good.
Coach further reinforced all the values I was being taught at home.
Okay.
And the parents listened to the coach when the coach said, I'm the coach. Mm. You're the parents. Mm-hmm. Be the parents.
Yeah, yeah.
Love your kid. give him a shoulder for his tears and teach him the valuable lessons of life. But let me teach him about the sport and how to compete. That relationship was so important that it really set me off into a great place. And it's the foundation for a lot of who I am as a parent.
That's awesome. As a parent myself and talking with some other buddies with similar age kids that are starting into their athletic world and just thinking about attitude and effort is going to be really great. We talk about that, but it's cool to hear that that was a foundation for you as well.
Yeah.
When did you know you were like on a different track? When did it like separate from, we've all played sports, we've all envisioned ourselves being in the Olympics or winning the big tournament or being on TV, but when did it separate from just being a really good local Michigan, standout, we'll say, to there's something, we're on a different track?
So you referenced results earlier.
Yeah.
If my coach hadn't been focused on the process and really instilling the core values of an athlete, the results I was experiencing would have put me in the library or into the music
back
studio
home.
Or something. It would not have kept me on the tennis court. And I think that was a value. Tennis was a dream from a pretty early age, probably about 10. where I really started to realize how much of a connection I had with the sport when I was with it. I got to be a very good junior youth player from a national standpoint when I was about 16, 17. That was a marked improvement from where I had been most of my childhood. It wasn't until I was a senior, I'd finished my senior in high school, and I got to play in the French Open junior tournament. I got to play in the Italian Open junior tournament, and then I made it to the semifinals of the U.S. Open junior tournament, playing against the world's best juniors and competing successfully against them. That was really the first time that I could justifiably say this is an objective of mine to be able to play professionally,
wow.
as opposed to, boy, wouldn't it be nice?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Now, who did you look up to when you were? Did you have guys on your wall? Were you? You know, was there anybody who, like, you're sort of?
John Havlicek.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, so basketball, like I said, was my first true love. My father's favorite basketball player was John Havlicek.
And he was a little gangly too, right?
Yeah, just, you know, sort of, you know, just, and you know, Charlie Hustle, just, yeah. I think, absolutely committed to
the blue collar
doing
what
was necessary, what the coach asked, and so forth.
But not a tennis player?
No.
Oh, interesting.
Nobody knew I was a tennis player because I met him once on a golf course, and I was on the practice green, and I heard this voice from behind me, and he said, "Tennis players can't putt."
Yeah.
And I looked up, and my dad had passed not much more than 5 years earlier.
Yeah.
And I looked up, and I was like, oh my gosh, my dad would have just gone bonkers. But, you know, I didn't have a tennis role model. I didn't have sort of that icon that I thought was so special that I needed to be like them.
Okay.
However, I had four. So it was nice. And, you know, Jimmy Connors, the feistiest competitor you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
John McEnroe, the most talented, gifted, graceful athlete. Yvonne Lendl, who obviously brought a work ethic that was admirable and didn't, at the time, I didn't think had the personality. And then Bjorn Borg, who was just still, yet fierce. And so I looked at all four of them and said, I can learn a lot from all four of these, not thinking that had I been 10 years older or learned the game 10 years earlier, I would have had somebody like Arthur Ashe or Rod Laver or Stan Smith to model myself after.
Sure.
Because all three of them, in my opinion, were the total package.
I've got to ask like a fanboy question, I guess. I don't get to meet a lot of pro athletes, but in my own athletic endeavors, I remember the mental anguish that preceded, especially an individual sport like you were in. What did you think about? I mean, obviously you were doing it and competing from a young age, but as the stakes got higher and as like this tournament, a win is going to make a huge difference in my life and a loss is going to make a major impact and I got all these people staring at me, my girlfriend, my parents, everybody I know from my hometown is watching this thing. Like the pressure just starts to mount and mount. I'm wondering how you handled that. Did you handle it differently at the beginning than the end? What's it like being in your head during, before, after competition?
The oversimplification of it is at one day you play in front of your parents. The next day you play in front of your friends. The next day you play in front of your classmates. And then, you know, and so your audience is growing very incrementally, assuming your development progresses. There are certainly plateaus in there. And so those plateaus were not necessarily created by the amount of attention, but the prestige.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hit a few barriers. Early in my career, I had a barrier of getting into what I would call the proper tour, which is probably about the top 100 to 125 players worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
I got right there and sort of just stagnated. And I, one year, early in my career, I lost in the second round 16 out of 19 tournaments. If you're winning a match in 16 tournaments, you're a really, really capable tennis player.
Right.
There's no doubt about it. If you're losing second round all the time, there's something in here that's not working. And so I didn't hit that very often, but there were two experiences in particular at the very pinnacle of our sport. One represents a very private failure, mm-hmm. and another represents the most public failure of my life.
Oh.
So I made it to the finals of the Australian Open in 1994. I was 23 at the time. I was 15 in the world, maybe something like this. So it was not ridiculous for me to be towards the end of the tournament. Yeah. However, being in the finals, it was Super Bowl Sunday, the day that we played.
Okay.
And my coach and I were in Melbourne, Australia. This was before anything remotely resembling the internet existed. And so my coach and I were trying to figure out, how do I play the match in Melbourne and get to Sydney, Australia, where we could go to the Hard Rock Cafe and watch the football game from there?
Very important, yeah.
I mean, of all the things in the world.
Yeah, you're
and so, you know, we spent a good bit of time the day before the final. You know, I practiced. I did all the things I normally do, but my mind was not nearly as focused on the task at hand as it should have been. As we all, I think, grow to learn, when we lay our heads on our pillows, we actually start to think a little bit more clearly about what's really important in my life. And I realized, hey, I'm playing in the finals of the Australian Open
tomorrow
morning. I know,
it seems like a bigger deal than the Super Bowl.
And so I didn't sleep that night.
Oh, okay.
I had not come to any grips with the nervous feelings or anxiety that I was going to feel walking out on the court. And it hit me hard. Mm. So I didn't sleep. The next morning, I couldn't eat. I went out, and if you look at the result, I lost 7-6, 6-4, 6-4 to Pete Sampras, the best player in the world.
Sure.
Nobody would think twice about that.
Yeah.
They would just say, great tournament,
yeah,
congratulations.
You
know, but it was a tremendous failure. I didn't put myself in any position to even believe that I could succeed.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if the result would have been better. It might have been worse had I done everything the right way, but I don't know that.
Yeah.
And so I really lost control of what I should have been controlling.
Yeah.
And then the other was, I was in the semifinals of Wimbledon in 96 and was up 5-1 in the fifth set. So I only had to win one more game. And there, winning one more game on that surface, on the grass courts, shouldn't be difficult.
Yeah.
I was playing a good friend of mine who was also a neighbor down in Florida. This one I really just choked. My mind was going a mile a minute and was the least organized it could possibly be. I couldn't have added two and two together for you at that moment. And late in that set, I was shaking so badly, and I knew it, that I stopped drinking water because I knew the cameras were on me. I didn't want the whole world to see just how, because I wouldn't have been able to hold the water in the cup.
Wow.
And it just, I mean, I was already embarrassed. I was already thinking about so many things other than how do I play this point as well as I can.
Yeah. Did you come out of that thinking, all right, I got to control the controllables?
My childhood coach was with me, actually, in London that year. And he was, I think, sort of an armchair psychologist. He was really, really...
Most coaches probably.
Really
are.
Wise.
Good ones.
Really, really wise.
Yeah.
And he said, you should talk to somebody about this. Don't let this go to waste.
Yeah.
And so I got home, and probably within a week, I was with a sports psychologist.
Okay.
And it was really helpful overall. It was tremendously helpful. But what was most helpful is the introduction to the first conversation. He goes, don't think of me as a shrink.
Yeah.
And so, all right, well, tell me what I'm supposed to think of you as. He said, think of me as an organizer of thought.
Okay.
And that's really what it was. I only worked with him for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And I played better. I was better after those experiences because of that. And because I actually started just accepting who I was and what I was doing and what I was in control of and what I wasn't.
The fresher aspect heightens all that so quickly.
Yep.
And you don't, if you're not ready for it, it can eat you alive, as you're saying here.
In the semifinals of Wimbledon, I was a mess. In the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, I was rock solid.
No problem, right?
Yeah, I was rock solid. But then you get one step closer to that prize, you start thinking about things that are not controllable and really destructive to your to your purpose.
So later in your career, you had that now behind you, almost a quiver to say, I've got to approach things differently with the help of the mind organizer guy.
Yeah.
You're able to kind of say, all right, I got to think about this thing differently. That must have been a huge lesson for you to learn then and maybe for the rest of your life.
It was a great lesson. It was simple. And I don't always keep things simple in my own head. I think, and it's one of the great challenges I have in bringing team members at the Hall of Fame into the discussion, because you know what's going on in the head is oftentimes a mess. This fellow really helped just simplify things. So it was a great growth mechanism. And what I found it did also was it recentered me. It recentered me in what I was taught as a child and what was important to me. You know, during this same time, my dad had been diagnosed with leukemia. Mm. I knew he wasn't going to be with us that much longer, which exacerbated everything.
Yeah.
But his passing and this lesson that I had learned the year prior put me in a position to think just a lot more about what type of perspective I should be having and working to, you know, make my father proud at all times, you know, not just on the court, off the court, and so forth. Yeah.
I can only imagine that he was proud, probably.
I think so. I was taught that pride is a sin, and my parents did a very good job of living
But I think they felt like they did a good job with you, even if you hadn't made it to the finals of this or that.
No, I think on that side of things, they didn't have anything to worry about. Their expectations were very low. They wanted me to benefit from sport,
as
a human, not as an athlete, but just benefit from sport as a human.
So I've got one more fanboy question, and that is, what's it like being a professional athlete? I mean, you dream of it, you see it, you watch it on TV. My kids are at the age where they're fantasizing about being these, you know, NFL quarterbacks or whatever. But I just wonder, is it thrilling? Is it nerve-wracking? Is it, one more win and I'm a superstar, one more loss and I'm, you know, no longer being a tennis player anymore? I just wonder, and individual sports are even different than team, but was it great? I mean, it's 16 years, right? So that seems like an incredible long time. And you're saying at 34, I could have kept going.
Well, I could have. We've got. I mean, Venus Williams is 40 years old right now, still playing. And so I think our bodies can survive it. I don't know always if our minds can, because it does require a level of precision, not necessarily in skill development, but in performance and in psychological and emotional control, that is really hard to come by. But professional athletics, I've told you almost the extent of my on-court memories.
Yeah,
it sounds silly, and I'm joking in a way. But my memories are from the human lessons I learned, from the cultural experiences I had and the friendships I developed with everybody from all over the place, and from India to Argentina to Australia to to Flint, Michigan. My buddy, who was neighbor of me, who I lost to at Wimbledon, grew up an hour away from me in Michigan.
It's a hotbed of tennis.
Yeah, no, it's just crazy. but you know, it's exhilarating when it's exhilarating. It's heartbreaking when it's heartbreaking. Mm. And there's a lot of normalcy in between. Yeah. It's, you know what, I play at 4 o'clock today. So that means I've got to get up at 8, have breakfast, do this, and this, play my match, do this. And just like, it's so routine, just like getting up and going to work and planning your next step. Probably the biggest difference between then professionally and now professionally is every week it went away. So you start every week anew. Mm-hmm. So I got to play my first round in five to seven days. I might be holding the trophy. In 2 hours, I might be done with the tournament. And whether you win or you lose, the circus moves on the next week.
Yeah.
And that's not real life. I mean,
is that good or bad?
From educating you on what real life is, it's bad. Because come 35, I was like, wait a second. Why can't we wash the slate clean and move on? We got a new week starting. Yeah. And it is something that I rue. I mean, like, I'm nostalgic about because after the pandemic, wouldn't it be nice if we could just wash our hands of it and start clean and
let's do it again?
But these issues they persist and nothing ever goes away entirely.
Well, I want to transition to the things that you've learned and you know, my first memories of you when I met you was this, you know. Oh, he's a pro athlete and something about tennis and something. And then I meet you and you instantly put everybody at ease. Maybe it was a self-deprecating comment or just your mannerisms, and everybody just wanted to be your best friend right after that. And that to me really stuck out. And so when I found out you were a Midwestern, and I'm from the Midwest as well, I thought, well, that's it. But how do you, do you think about that? Is that just who you are? Is there any ways that you put together or think about, you know, how you're going to, you mentioned relax your team members so you can bring them in, and I'm sure your job involves a lot of things across the board, not just team leadership and your own team at the Tennis Hall of Fame, but how does that personality trait that seems like is inherent to you, do you think about it? Do you try to make purposeful decisions so that you do that, because it's a tremendous skill. Given that, with your background, I think people would give you the respect you need, and for you to put people at ease seems like it would bring the best out of them. So I think it's really working.
Well, first of all, thank you. I think that I am who I am because I am who I am, right?
Fair enough.
And it starts at childhood. I had certain wiring. I referenced that I was timid. My parents raised me to be well-rounded. Mm-hmm. I'm nowhere near as well-rounded as they would have wished, but I've stayed true to that. They held me accountable at every turn, and that's really important. But a couple of things that stay in my mind and are values that I refer to all the time, and that's humility and respect. Mm. And these are things that were taught on the court, off the court, and were of value as well. You know, it's one thing to be taught certain values, but if you don't see the benefit of those values as a young person, sometimes it's harder to sustain those values. These values at every turn were really and truly benefits to me. But I also think that the relative timidness when I was young balanced with the success that I had as a professional. it was good. Tennis gave me more confidence than I was born with, if you will. But my background and some self-awareness tempered my ego as much as anything else. And I've valued the education that you can get from interpersonal engagement. And I was not a great student. I refer to it as swimming upstream in the academic river. But when you got me out of the classroom, I was a sponge, and I learned culture from observing these cities that I visited and spending time with a very diverse group of tennis players. I learned writing and speech through being put through press conferences and writing articles as a guest columnist or whatever. And for me, life has always been the best education. But you have to be very self-aware in order to make the most of what life has to offer you.
I can only imagine being 23 years old, being in the finals of one of the Grand Slam events, and then being humble and respectful. I think that must have been really tricky, because you're like, you went to the moon, and yet you were, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how you were as a person at that age, but man, just seeing you now and thinking how difficult I think that would be for most people to hang on to those two values when you're basically one of the best at your craft of anyone on the planet.
So I look at Tony Dungy, the former Indianapolis Colt football coach and now NBC broadcaster. I look at him as being probably the quintessential, humble, wonderful human being who's achieved levels of success that you... you should only dream of. Nobody should be able to achieve that, right? But I bet you if you had a heart-to-heart with Tony Dungy, he would say, I was humbled as well. It wasn't like I always demonstrated great humility, but I recognized it was important enough to me that when I didn't, it kept me awake at night. And so when I talk to young athletes, I talk about humility. Yeah. If you're humble, you're never going to let the highs get you too high and the lows get you too low.
Amazing.
But it all depends on self-awareness you have without being self-conscious.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's where I was. You know, I was timid and self-conscious, but just sort of dragged out of that shell along the way.
Wow. When you left tennis, and you said you did so at your own volition, which is pretty remarkable. We probably could talk a long time about
that. With a little nudge.
Someone told me no one ends their athletic career
so
on their own accord.
That is so true.
You finished tennis, you hang it up. You're married with kids at the time?
One son at the time, yeah. Amy and I had been married for... creeping up on 3 years, and actually creeping up on 4 years when I retired, and our son was a year and a half.
So then just tell us a little bit about your life post-tennis, pre-Newport, Rhode Island. How did you end up here in Newport, the best city in the world?
It happened just the way it wasn't supposed to happen. So I was certain, I was mentoring several young professionals throughout the second half of my career.
Okay.
And I loved it. I just, you know, going out and practicing with them, giving some pointers, helping their coaches out, aiding with sort of how to manage the off court shenanigans that everybody has to deal with. And I just loved that. Yeah. And growing up, I wanted to be a school teacher. So this was like a great amalgamation of my greatest passion in my life with a student base that would, I think, really benefit. I thought would really benefit from my experiences. And so, a month after I retired, a fellow named Marty Fish, at the time he was probably 23 years old, I think, 22 years old when he when he asked me to coach him. Marty was a silver medalist in the Olympics. He's now the Davis Cup captain for the U.S. and, you know, wonderful guy and just beaming with talent at the time and less disciplined. And he needed somebody like me to come in and give him some structure. And I spent almost 3 years helping him out. I love him. I loved being with him. However, there was something that was missing. I wasn't nearly as direct and forceful in my coaching with him as he needed me to be. And I would have been had been more experienced as a coach. There was a lack of gratification that I couldn't really put my fingers on. And then, I don't know, a year or two later, Novak Djokovic contacted me and asked me to do the same with him. Mm-hmm. And with Novak, he has a large team, a coach that's been with him for a long, long time, a strength and conditioning coach, a physiotherapist, an agent. You know, there's
a team.
It's parents, a girlfriend, now a wife. I mean, it was, but they asked me to come in and sort of lead that charge, and I spent about 10 months working with Novak, and I was able to put my finger on the problem.
Okay.
Because I had all the same issues.
Yeah.
And it was really the notion that one student is just not enough. It was like I was married twice. So the stifling nature of being able to watch this one player play, trying to spend at that level, you only have maybe 5 minutes over the course of a day to really impact this player who already plays at such a level that he's looking for an extra tenth of a percent in improvement. And that's just not an all day, every day experience. And I just didn't, there just wasn't enough. There wasn't enough depth. There wasn't enough focus and stimulation of content for me. Mm-hmm. I would have had to be the guy who just loved the film room and just spent 8 hours a day scrolling through film and seeing it just wasn't me. Not long after that, I started a business in Florida teaching hundreds of kids. Okay. And it was great in concept, and I really enjoyed elements of it. Before long, I was running a business, though.
Yeah.
So I did something so that I could, like you, I did something so I could be an architect. And then all of a sudden, I was doing the bookkeeping.
Yeah, you're running the other architects.
Yeah. And so I got to be envious of all the of all the coaches that were spending the time with the kids. Mm. And that's when the Hall of Fame opportunity came up.
Okay, nice. Yeah. And so, tell us about life here in Newport, what you're doing with the Tennis Hall of Fame, you know, how you're using things that you learned throughout your life and implementing them here. Is this a good fit?
Yeah, I've been on staff now for 6 years, and it's been the most gratifying experience I've had since playing tennis,
wow,
for sure.
Cool.
It's been the most educational experience, and I think that's really important to be aware of. Mm-hmm. And for me, being a guy who always sought education through experience, this experience has been a constant, like, wow, this is the first time I've ever seen this. This is the first time that I've ever seen that. Yeah. Of course, it's the first time any of us have seen a global pandemic.
Yeah.
But
you're not ready for this? What are you talking about?
Not quite prepared. For me, that's been the greatest joy. And and similar to starting my own business, I came up here because I wanted to make an impact on the sport globally.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like the rest of my life, I've taken more from the experience than I've given to the experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, and that's a blessing that I never would have imagined. I get to work with the most dedicated team of 40 staff members that range from selling merchandise from Bellevue Avenue to teaching tennis at our club, to running our tennis tournament, to fundraising on behalf of the history of the sport to running a museum. I mean, it's just so vast. It's so vast. It's been perfect for me because
challenging, right?
You need to be a generalist, and I wasn't a generalist by profession. I was a generalist by lack of profession. So we've really worked hard at expanding the reach of the Hall of Fame, the building the brand, making sure that the international tennis world is aware of the importance and impact of tennis culture and history. Mm. You know, you think about what's going on in our society today, and my favorite artifact in our museum is a telegram from Jackie Robinson to Arthur Ashe when he won the first U.S. Open in 1968.
Wow.
There are elements of my job that move me to tears in a bad way sometimes, but stimulate such joy. Some of it is that service to the sport, and I know I'm doing something important for our sport, for my sport. It's just so gratifying to be in another community, another culture, which is much different than North Florida where I was, and way different than Lansing, Michigan. But I've learned so much from those around me here.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you as a neighbor, a friend, an icon here in Newport. I mean, I'm, as I said, a Midwesterner, but I fell in love with this city because it's just so cool. It's small but big at the same time, and you meet just super interesting people. Everybody seems to be from somewhere else in the world or the country, so you get this super cool mix of people. So it's really great to have you here and be part of that. And you're an amazing ambassador. Just your personality, obviously your history with the sport, but I think when you see you applying your craft in the way you do, it really seems like it's clicking really well. You've done well in the business world and in your leadership style, obviously in the sports style, and your personality is awesome. Is there anything you can leave somebody with that's going to say, you know, these are the things that you focus on or you're still focusing on, or even things you're grappling with now that you think could be something, a feather in someone's cap they could learn from and take from and be better in their own craft?
There's a few things that I think are just absolutely critical. One is building a team. Any leader has to build a team that they can trust with who they are. Mm. There's a great importance in leadership for your team to actually know you. And as much as you want to know them, and you want to know what they're doing and what they're thinking about when you think they should be thinking about your business, it's really important to be transparent, which isn't always that easy for me. I've got some natural introversion, and it's really important that I'm more sharing of myself. That's one thing. I spoke about self-awareness earlier. I think that connects really well with that. Yeah. Listening is huge. I make the mistake of asking questions in the form of statements. And there's so often a pregnant pause of, oh, wait, is there a question there? Yeah. But the more intentional you can be about listening and gleaning the feedback that you're seeking without formulating your rebuttal. Yeah, it's something that I'm not great at, but it's when I'm good at it, I actually recognize that the benefit
how
of it.
Powerful.
And then probably the third thing is know who you are and lead through that image. Mm-hmm. I just don't think you're gonna build that trust. If I were hyper type A and viciously competitive, it would look really strange if I somehow tried to position myself as the boy next door.
Yeah.
And everybody can detect a fraud.
Spot it. Yeah.
Everybody can detect a fraud.
Yeah. Those are great. Well, thank you, Todd, so much for spending this time with us. Your temperament, your life lessons, ooh and ah about your great accomplishments on the court, but really sort of get excited about what you're doing and going forward. You know, you got a great family living in the best city in the world, and we're just so thankful for you to spend the time with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Spencer. You guys are doing a great thing here, and I love driving all over the town and seeing the CDA signs, so keep it
up. That's nice. Thank you. All right, great.